They could not easily believe that the streams which had nourished them so long could dry up. In the purlieus of Westminster, bribes were paid like pensions, long after it had been forgotten whose interest was secured by them. "We want results," he said quietly. "We're tired of waiting. It is possible that you imagine we would rather pay you for nothing than risk your disfavour by ceasing. If so, you had better disabuse yourself. That may have been the case in the time of my predecessor, but I assure you it is not the case now. I take the view that when a man's friendship has not helped us, we have nothing to fear from his enmity." He got up, looking squarely at the man before him. "You, on the other hand, have much to fear from ours," he said. "Put on wisdom with your wig today, Sir William, and ponder my words well. I trust I make my meaning clear to you."
"Abundantly crystalline, sir. Curse me, translucent," Templeton said, meeting the other's gaze with tolerable firmness.
On this less than cordial note, the two men parted. Kemp found his chairman waiting in the courtyard with a sedan, as instructed, but he paid them and sent them away, feeling the need for air and movement. He left the King's Gate on his left and began to walk towards Hyde Park Corner, crossing the Westbourne by the little wooden footbridge. After a while he became aware of a stinging sensation in his right hand and saw that the palm bore shallow lacerations which were bleeding slightly. He could not at first understand this. Then he realised that it must have happened during his interview with Templeton. He had clenched his fist so tightly that he had cut himself with his nails. Only the right one, he thought vaguely. He had been holding his cane with the other. Increasingly these days he found himself becoming aware of overwrought feeling through some discomfort felt later, rather as one is woken by some pain in the night. He had the wall of the park now on his left. Across from him, on the opposite side, there was a row of small houses, then the White Horse Inn, with St. George's Hospital beyond it, fronting on to Knightsbridge. He crossed the road and turned off alongside the hospital garden, which ran into Grosvenor Place. This had no buildings at its lower end, giving directly onto the open heathland known as Five Fields. Kemp stood for a while here, looking out over the ponds and brick kilns. It was a quiet corner. The rumble of carts and coaches on the cobbles of Piccadilly and the cries of hawkers came to him, but distantly. A ragged, crippled man was playing a barrel organ at the Knightsbridge end of the square, dragging one leg and glancing up at the windows for pennies. The music carried to Kemp softened and distorted, unrecognisable. He could see the gleam of the ponds, and gulls squealing above them, and the figures of fishermen. It was early October, and the weather had been wet and windy, though today there was some faint sunshine. He could smell the damp leaf mould from the garden behind him. He recalled with distaste the conversation just past, the posturing and evasions of Templeton. He had nailed the fellow, though, in the end. What steps could have led him to such a man? He could almost believe he had come upon him by some unrepeatable chance, as one might come upon a creature in a labyrinth. But, of course, it was not by chance. He experienced a slight feeling of nausea at the openness of the sky, the flashes of the gull's wings over the pale water, the spaces beyond. London ended here, his London at least. It lay all to the back of him, the precincts of government, the banks and counting-houses, and with it lay all he had achieved in these 12 years, his partnership in Fletcher and Company, his holdings in his father-in-law's bank, his house in St. James's, the power and position that had come with his money. He had laboured and denied himself and stopped at nothing, however unworthy. His promise, his father's memory, had purged everything of wrong. In restoring his father's name and credit, he had established and consolidated his own. Kemp was a name to be reckoned with again, and he was still some months away from his 35th birthday. It was a triumph. He looked again at the solitary fisherman, dark in the distance. There would be pike in those deep ponds. Beyond them, he knew, there was the toll gate, and beyond that the road through the market gardens of Marylebone and the fields where the cowkeepers had their shacks. Something, some nostalgia or desire for completeness, came to him with the strength of a physical impulse, though without aim or direction. The music of the barrel organ was nearer now. Kemp moved away across the square, but after a moment returned to give the man a florin. For a moment he met the dark eyes, saw marks of hardship on the face, had a fleeting sense of the streets the man would drag through, grinding out the same tunes. He went down the steps and cut across the park, past the keeper's lodge, and came out on Piccadilly, turning off again when he drew opposite the reservoir. His house was on one corner of St. James's Square, overlooking the railed gardens. He found his wife at home, as he had expected, still in her bedroom. It was past midday now, but she had just risen. He knew her movements well. She would spend 2 hours at least on her toilette, take her tea and leave the house at late afternoon on a round of visits. They would not meet again that day, perhaps not until this time tomorrow. He wanted to speak to her about her father, Sir Hugo, with whom he was now on rather bad terms because of recent business disagreements, and because it was to her father that Margaret complained of him. The elderly French maid was in the room, clearing away the remains of breakfast. He noted that as soon as he appeared, she began to delay. Fritz, his wife's poodle, yapped when he entered. There was an old enmity between them, unyielding on both sides. Margaret Kemp chided her dog and greeted her husband in more or less the same tones. Across the top of her head there lay a large round cushion, covered with black crepe, over which the hair was combed back and fastened with curlers. She was a martyr to fashion, and the fashion now was for a high, piled-up style. Her face was completely covered with white cream. "Will you ask her to take away the things and leave us alone for a while?" Kemp said, receiving in response a snap of black eyes from the maid. Marie shared the poodle's feelings precisely. "Why? You know she does not gossip." Kemp sighed. It was the second time that morning. "I know nothing of the sort," he said. "Can you not exist for 10 minutes without her presence in the room?"
"I'm glad I have not a suspicious nature," his wife said. "Go, Marie. I'll ring when I need you."
Kemp waited until the maid had gone, then began to speak to her about her father's latest passion, which was for speculating in negroes. The old man had somehow become convinced, and how and by whom were among the things Kemp most wanted to know, that the trade in slaves was shortly to be made illegal by Act of Parliament. He had instructed his agents in Barbados and Virginia to buy up as many blacks as possible in order to get compensation for the government when the bill was passed into law.
"He's going mad," Kemp said. "That is the only possible conclusion. There is no such bill in prospect. There are not above 3 members of Parliament who take the abolitionist line. I am told reliably that your father is buying up negroes of no quality whatever, with no value on the market. Old, diseased, crippled, it makes no difference. He has got fixed in his mind this absurd notion of compensation. The blacks will all have to be fed and kept alive somehow at great expense. Half of them will die on his hands in spite of everything."
The mask of cream which covered his wife's face allowed no expression except what showed in her eyes. These were brown and glistening and full of ill humour. They were not looking at him.
"Could you not find an occasion to speak to him and dissuade him from this folly?" he said.
"Lord, sir," she said, "you speak with rare feeling. 'Twas in those very tones you wooed me. I would not have credited you with such tender solicitude for my father's welfare."
Kemp said nothing for a while. Pride made him wish to seem indifferent to the sarcasm. With the same indifference he showed towards the irregularities of her conduct, her absences from home, her suspected infidelities. At heart he felt it to be no more than justice. He saw it as he might have seen a balance sheet. The money she had brought had provided substantial investment funds much earlier than he had hoped, at a time of expanding opportunity in the London property market. She had saved him the many years of scheming it would still have taken to pay off his father's debts. He had protested love in order to get her, and since he had not repaid her in that currency, she was free to choose other means of repayment. He kept to his side of things by not reproaching her, and it was this that gave her the greatest offence of all. He looked at her obscured face, the grotesquely high setting of her hair. 7 years of marriage, and he could not remember a time when there had been trust between them.
"Well," he said at last, "if you have any regard for him, you will disabuse his mind."
A thought struck him suddenly.
"Try to discover who is communicating these ideas to him," he said.
She had begun to remove the cream from her face with moist pieces of cotton, dropping the used swabs into a little silver dish on the bed beside her. The clear complexion she had possessed when he married her and which had been her best feature, was gone now. Unhappiness had made her sallow, and frequent use of cosmetics was clouding the skin. "You are asking me, in other words, to spy on my own father," she said after a moment.
"It is for his good and ours, the good of the bank. I'm asking from you no more than the duty of a wife."
Kemp had no sense of irony in saying this, and was surprised to see a smile come to his wife's face. The interests of the bank were paramount in his mind. He took a few steps across the room.
"I would be interested to know who is spreading these rumours of abolition," he said.
His movements had brought him too close to the cushion on which the poodle was reclining, and it set up a furious yapping, baring its teeth and shaking the beribboned tufts of its mane at him.
"Be quiet, you little brute," he said.
"Pray do not disturb poor Fritz."
"Poor Fritz, is it?" Kemp eyed the beast. "I've never been able to see what a dog like that is good for."
A silence fell between them. Now that he had said what he had come to say, he did not know what else to talk about. His wife's activities and interests were remote to him, her circle of acquaintance quite different.
"I shall not be at home this evening," he said at last. "I'm dining out. I shall not need the coach, however."
"Well, that is a blessing. You are at your club?"
"No, it is a celebration banquet of the association. I have spoke to you of it, I think."
But he saw that she remembered nothing of the matter, and he himself could not be sure whether he had mentioned it to her or not. He certainly would have said nothing about the plans of the younger element to go on afterwards to a Covent Garden tavern for a meeting of the Triumphi Club, of which he had now, as vice president of the West India Association, become the leading figure. The activities of the Triumphi were under oath of secrecy, but he thought it possible he had mentioned the banquet, as it was such a great occasion. The assembly in Jamaica, in order to raise revenue, had sought to impose a duty on every negro imported into the colony. The sugar interest, supported by the company of merchants trading to Africa, had naturally resisted this iniquitous tax on their profits. There had been a protracted legal battle, but the association's lawyers had pleaded the matter successfully, and the Board of Trade had finally condemned the law as unjustifiable, improper, and prejudicial to British commerce. Something of this he tried to tell her now, but quite soon she interrupted him to ask if Marie could be recalled.
"I must have her back," she said. "I did not think you'd stay so long. She must positively come and unpin this cushion. She is the only creature in the world that knows how to do it."
On this, he took his leave. He spent the afternoon closeted in his study with his secretary, dealing with correspondence of various sorts. His position in the association, which he took very seriously, had involved him in much extra work. The president, Sir James Wigmore, over 80 now and increasingly infirm, did little these days but put in an appearance on ceremonial occasions. He was due to make a speech at the banquet that evening. This was to be held at the premises of the African Merchants, off Chancery Lane. The members of the association were guests of the company for the evening. The streets were miry after the recent rain, and he wore a long riding cloak to protect his royal blue satin suit. He stabled his horse in the courtyard, consigned cloak and boots to the stable boy, changed into the elegant wedge-heeled shoes he had brought with him, and mounted to the anterooms, where he was announced in stentorian tones. There were a number of people already assembled here, several of them known to him. Sir James arrived and passed directly into the dining hall, distributing smiles, his head in its full-bottomed wig trembling incessantly. He was deftly supported to his place at the head of the table by a liveried footman of Herculean proportions. His installation was the signal for the call to dinner. The orchestra in the gallery struck up with Conquering Heroes, and some 70 persons trooped to their places at the long table amidst the splendour of coffered ceilings, double rows of Doric pillars, and gleaming stucco mouldings in blue and gold, recently completed by the Italian plasterer Pietro Francini at very considerable expense. The first toast came, as usual, after the soup. It was delivered by the chairman of the company, who welcomed the guests and drank perdition to any who would lay import duties on British goods. Sir James was then helped to his feet by the footman, who stood behind his chair. He gave thanks to their hosts on behalf of the West India Association and raised his glass to the principles so triumphantly vindicated by the recent decision of the tribunal. He added his congratulations to those who had pleaded the case, and particularly the advocate who had led them, Mr. Joshua Moore, who was a guest of honour that evening. Through their victory, the value to the nation of the triangular trade had been clearly recognised. The East India trade was pernicious, in his opinion, draining England of bullion and committing her to buy unnecessary wares. The Africa trade, by contrast, was a sane and healthy trade, carried on by means of English manufactured goods and rendering the nation independent of foreigners for a supply of tropical products. Sir James drew himself up and looked with palsied benignity round the table.
"And to what tropical product do I refer in particular, gentlemen? May I hear your answer?"
The reply came in jovial shouts.
"Sugar, sir, sugar! So, here is to sugar," the old man said, and drank a second glass amid cheers.
Kemp, sitting a little lower down the table, glanced at the lawyer who had been placed opposite him. Moore had a sharp-boned, watchful face, flushed a little now with what he had drunk. He had listened with good-humoured impassivity to Sir James's congratulations. Meeting Kemp's eye, he nodded and raised his glass.
"Your health, sir," he said.
"And yours."
Kemp rarely drank enough to disturb his judgment, but he was drinking more than usual tonight. He felt some tension about the meeting of the Triumphi planned for later. It was his inauguration as the new president of the club, and his conduct would come under scrutiny.
"Some of us may differ from Sir James as regards the East India trade," he said to Moore, "but we're unanimous in our admiration for the way you conducted our case."
The fellow would have been just as eloquent on the other side if his fee had come from that quarter, he thought with some disgust. Lawyers were mercenary creatures. This one was Irish, too, a nation of talkers.
"I am glad of your good opinion," Moore said with a slight smile. "I take it you approve of the East India trade."
Kemp hesitated a moment from habitual caution, but this was public knowledge.
"My firm supports the company of Elliot and Son," he said. "They're one of the main importers of China tea. Did you know that duty was paid on more than £6 million of tea coming into this country last year? And the volume will increase. All reports indicate that our new colony of India is capable of large-scale production. The East India Company is doing us a service. The more tea, the more sugar. It takes no prodigious wit to see that."
"I see you are far-sighted, sir,"
the other said. There was something slightly ironical in the tone of this. Kemp found himself being regarded by a pair of humorous blue eyes.
"Tell me now," the lawyer said softly, "with all this tea coming in, do you not think the price will fall so that the common people can afford it?"
"Why, yes, in time."
"In quite a short time, do you not think? And if they take to drinking tea, will they not require sugar in vast quantities?"
"Of course."
Kemp refilled his glass. He was nettled by the other's manner. It was as if he were being rather teasingly cross-examined. He was aware that others nearby were listening.
"And that will help our business," he said curtly. "Any fool can see that."
"Here is one who can't," the lawyer said with unruffled good humour. "You are digging your own pit, sir, if you will pardon me. We are talking about a time when tea will be cheaper than beer. Once the magnitude of the sugar market is grasped, do you think that control of the prices will be left in the hands of a few West Indian planters? People will look elsewhere for their sugar, sir, wherever it is cheapest. There is no divine right in commerce."
Kemp was indignant. He could not imagine any government of whatever complexion exposing the nation to foreign competition. One country could only grow rich at the expense of another. It was an axiom and an article of faith with him. But he had no time to retort upon the lawyer. The remains of the beef were being cleared. They would be bringing in the sorbet. It was time for him, as vice president, to propose the health of their hosts, the Africa merchants. He got to his feet and rapped with his spoon for silence. This took some time to obtain, as the guests were loud and heated now with food and drink. He spoke easily and well, timing his pauses, inserting the humorous remarks prepared beforehand. Though still as scornful as ever of actors, he had learned much about the art of pleasing over the years. When he came to the heart of his speech, he grew serious, pointing out the value and importance of the slave trade, on which every man in the room in some way depended. It was a sign of this value and importance that through all variation in the administration of public affairs, through all variation of government and party, this trade had always been approved, its encouragement voted, its benefit to the nation recognised on all sides. These were the things, above all, that this company of men enjoyed hearing, and he resumed his seat to general applause. He did not speak again to the lawyer, or look at him, but devoted his attention to the man on his right, who was already well known to him, as to most people in the room, and always to be found at these gatherings. Dr. Ebenezer Slingsby, familiarly known among his associates as Dr. Sugar, was a man who had done more for the trade in his own way than almost anyone, having been for more than 30 years a tireless publicist for the medicinal virtues of sugar in every form, and having published, not much previously, a learned treatise entitled A Vindication of Sugar, in which he proved beyond doubt that sugar was beneficial to everyone, of whatever degree or age or sex. Throughout all this time, his researches had been helped forward by generous subsidies from the West India Association. Slingsby was corpulent and somewhat short of breath, and his teeth were ruinous, but his full, round face had a good high shine on it, and his eyes glistened as he described to Kemp his new remedy for all ailments of the eye: 2 drams of fine sugar candy, 1 grain of leaf gold, 1/4 dram pearl.
"Made into a very fine and impalpable powder, sir," the doctor said. "When dry, blow a convenient quantity into the eye. Relief will be felt within 2 minutes."
"The pearl and gold leaf will make it an expensive remedy, I fancy," Kemp said. "Beyond the means of most."
"That is true, sir. It is designed for people of fashion. But I am presently seeking patents for a hand lotion made from sugar paste, which will be a sovereign cure for all manner of external lesions, and, well, within the means of the common general. And I'm also working on a dentifrice made with powdered sugar, which should come out cheap enough. Alas, too late to save my own teeth."
The smile he gave at this point attested in a graphic fashion to the terminal condition of these.
"But we do not work for ourselves alone," he said. "It is the younger generation who will thank us. There is a Slingsby sugar snuff now on the market, which I believe will replace tobacco entirely, to the better health of the whole population."
The doctor paused to drink some of his wine. His nails, Kemp noticed, were a strangely uniform whitish colour, without any evident presence of blood behind them.
"Well, that is good news," he said. "I had not thought sugar could be put to so many uses."
Dr. Sugar set down his glass.
"Sir," he said, "sugar has 1,000 uses. It is the most versatile of all commodities in the world. It is, first of all, a food, of course, and an excellent one. A man can live on the products of sugar alone for many weeks together without the smallest detriment, as I have proved upon my own person. But sugar is also a preservative, a solvent, a stabilizer. It is equally valuable as excipient or diluent. It gives consistency of body. It masks bitter-tasting drugs. It can be used in syrups and elixirs, as an emulsant or as a binding agent for tablets. It is a base for confections, oil sugars, aromatic sugars, candy cough lozenges. It improves the eyesight, preserves the hair, and sweetens the blood. Sir, there is no end to the virtues of sugar."
By the time Kemp had followed the doctor through this catalogue, he was beginning to feel the onset of drunkenness. However, when the guests rose, he was still steady enough in his movements and clear in speech. The place used by the Triumphi for their meetings was the Bell in Covent Garden, which boasted a good-sized dining room. In the cloakroom, where he had gone to divest himself of cloak and boots, Kemp found 4 men, all members of the club, sitting at cards with brandy on the table before them.
"Here's our worthy president," one of them said. "Stab me, why do you look so glum, man? Here, have some brandy. Get your flavour to the bottle."
Kemp saw that the man, whose name was Fowler, was drunk already. His waistcoat hung open, and the lace front of his shirt had a wet stain on it. Kemp drank from the bottle, and sighed loudly, and smiled round at the men, widening his eyes in a way that was peculiar to him, slightly devilish.
"This will wash out the taste of all those confounded speeches," he said, and drank again.
The men at the table had been looking at him expectantly. They all laughed now, as if in some kind of relief. Kemp had found something of his father's friendly manners in the course of paying off his debts. To the advantages of good looks and a well-knit figure, he had added the useful gift of bonhomie. But there was nothing of the father's simple and unaffected good fellowship in the way the son noted now, for future reference, that these men had not thought fit to attend the banquet, preferring to sit here over their cards. He knew them all for profligate and idle. They were the sons of plantation owners, men who had never known the want of money.
"They've got the ladies in already," one said.
Kemp could hear a considerable noise of voices from the dining-room adjoining, and the sound of the fiddlers playing a reel.
"I must go in," he said. "I hope that fool of a landlord has not let the women into the dining-room yet. They're to come in later."
"No," Fowler said with a loose smile. "They're upstairs, getting dressed for it, powdering their fannies."
He tilted back his chair and patted his crutch with an imaginary powder puff.
"You'll need something more than powder on it, Fowler, to stiffen you tonight," Kemp said. "Are you gentlemen not going in?"
They began to get up, but he did not wait, passing alone into the long, low-raftered room, where a fire of logs burned at one end. He greeted the dozen men there and took his place at the head of the table. Immediately on his right, as tradition required, was their guest for the evening, a man named Armstrong, the only one there not connected with Sugar. He was a lieutenant in the Guards, a relative of one of the members. While all remained standing, the retiring president, lisping in speech but impressively serious in manner, welcomed Kemp to his new office and handed him the ceremonial white baton, known as the cane. No member could command the attention of the others, nor speak to them collectively, without having this in his possession. Kemp tapped three times on the table with it, and formally declared the proceedings open. The serving man came forward with the port. Voices were raised now that the gravity of protocol had been laid aside. The drinking was reckless. Most of the men there had been tipsy when they sat down, but they drank off bumpers of wine as if it were water. There were toasts to King George and the Royal Princes and Squinting Kate, the Queen of Camden. Kemp got up while he still had his senses about him and expressed the hope that he would give satisfaction as the new president, a sentiment which was greeted by loud and sustained hammering on the table. Some wine was spilled in the course of this, and one or two glasses broken. An undercurrent of excitement ran below the high spirits. It was hot in the room. Kemp felt perspiration break out on him. Several of the men had discarded coats and waistcoats. The air was heavy with tobacco smoke and vinous breath. A low chant began from lower down the table.
"Triumphi, triumphi, triumphi."
Kemp made a signal to the two fiddlers, who broke into a rendering of Lads and Lassies. This was the cue for the club's Italian sugar chef, Signor Gasparini, to advance into the room in his tall hat and spotless white apron. Behind him, greeted by a rousing chorus of yells and whoops, came three attendants bearing a litter on which stood a 3-foot-high model of a negress fashioned in chocolate. Except for bracelets, anklets, and pearl collar, which were all made of sugar crystal droplets, and the red sugar paste rose in her hair, she was naked. To the continuing strains of the fiddle, they made the round of the table with her. At her base was a plaque of chocolate with letters picked out in spun sugar, the Sable Venus. Kemp rapped with his baton for silence.
"In accordance with custom, Signor Gasparini will now explain to the company the mysteries of this delectable lady's composition."
The chef had a lively eye and a smile so extensive that the corners of his lips and eyes seemed almost to join in a circle. The negretta was made of pasta di cioccolata e cacao, sweetened with fanid, flavoured with vanilla, moulded by his own hands. He threw them up with a gesture of a conjurer.
"The hers is made from caramella," he said jubilantly. "Her lips is pink pasta of sugar, the eyes zucchero fino. She have sugar cherries for nipples, dolcissimi, no? Ecco, signore, a voi!"
He swept off his tall hat and gestured proudly towards his creation, who regarded the company with gleaming, affrighted eyes.
"Only the best sugar go to make this fanciulla," Signor Gasparini said.
"What the devil is fanid?"
muttered the young lieutenant in Kemp's ear. It seemed he had experienced a moment of intellectual inquiry. His eyes were round with drink and wonderment.
"It is the juice of the sugar-cane after it has been boiled down and skimmed," Kemp said. "It makes a sweet black dough like thick syrup."
He stood up rather unsteadily and inclined his head to the chef.
"Gasparini," he said, "you have excelled yourself. My congratulations. The guest may now be served."
Armstrong, after some fuddled hesitation and to the accompaniment of much profane advice, chose the left breast with its cherry nipple. He was served with dexterity by the attendants, who could not, however, avoid some of the shoulder coming away with it. Thereafter the others were served, beginning with Kemp, who took her nose and eyes, proceeding down the table, the least senior members having to pick among the fragments. Sauterne was served, and a sweet, heavy Malaga wine. Kemp saw one of the junior members get up suddenly and make for the door, his face overspread with a chalky pallor. Fowler had slumped forward in his chair, his head rested on the table among the remains of his chocolate. So much for the powder puff, Erasmus thought. He was distinctly drunk himself now, but his stomach felt firm enough. The chanting began again, this time accompanied by a flat-handed striking at the table.
"Triumphi! Triumphi! Triumphi!" The volume rose, drowning out the fiddles. On the crest of it, laughing among themselves, the women came in, sent by the prudent landlord before things started to get broken.
There were eight of them, scantily dressed and painted and high-stepping. They had been given drink while waiting. They sat in the laps of the men who were quickest to catch them, except for one, who came unbidden to Erasmus, a wild-haired, gypsy-looking young woman with a bold mouth. She wore nothing above the waist but a muslin bodice. Her breasts moved unconfined below it, the nipples showing through with a dark glow. She drank from his glass and smiled at him, her eyes shining below the thick fringe of hair. Erasmus, whose senses were swimming now, and whose only care was to see that no one took away his precious baton of office, fumbled with the buttons of her bodice, at the same time trying to explain to Armstrong, with a vestigial sense of his duty as host, that the Triumphi were due to appear now. It was these that gave the club its name, little figures made from cast sugar.
"Cast on marble," he said, enunciating with immense care.
His tongue felt too thick for his mouth.
"The marble first lubricated with oil of almonds."
Armstrong did not appear to be listening closely. The girl on his lap had slid a hand inside his breeches. Gasparini's men brought them, in boxes tied with red ribbon, one for each person in the room. They were unwrapped and held up and turned this way and that in the lamplight, glistening white replicas of horseshoes, pigs, rosettes, shells, keys. A long-drawn "ah!" went round the table. Erasmus's girl had extracted from her box, as all had known she would since it was marked for her, a sugar penis, gleaming with crystals, heroically tumid, with a red tassel attached. Smiling, she held it up for all to see, and, as she did so, the chanting began again, a single barking syllable now,
"Up! Up! Up!"
She laid the dildo before Erasmus and leapt up in a single movement onto the table. Dishes, glasses, remnants of food were swept aside. She tossed her head and snapped her fingers at the hollow-eyed fiddlers, who went into the rhythm of a gavotte. She commenced a swaying dance in the centre of the table, removing her garments piece by piece and throwing them down among the spectators, petticoats, bustle, bodice, stockings. Naked, she was beautiful in the lamplight, her skin like warm pearl. She swooped for her gift, danced into a half-squatting position. Still to the stately rhythm of the music, she inserted it between her legs, pressing it slowly into herself with both hands, raising her face with an expression of simulated ecstasy, while the voices round her rose again, overlapping, indistinguishable, like the baying of dogs. The woman rose and raised her arms to show the hands were empty, and danced a few gyrating steps, keeping her knees close, working her thighs, rounding her mouth to make ooze of bliss. The crimson tassel hung down between her legs like some trailing tissue of blood. She kept to the centre of the table, stepping short, turning to avoid the hands that snatched, though more in jest than earnest, at the swinging cord. she came to rest where she had begun, before Erasmus, and smiled down at him and swayed her hips, while the whole table loudly exhorted their new president to take it out, 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 and he reached up and took the strip of velvet and drew on it, and a roar went up at the expected sight of how wilted and eroded that proud prick was now, how it dangled grotesquely misshapen on its thread. In accordance with hallowed custom, it had been made of powder sugar, designed for quick melting in the hot spice of the vagina. Erasmus knew what was expected of him. He rose and swung the naked woman off the table and set a staggering course with her towards the door. Then he remembered the cane, symbol of his office, and came back for it. On inspired impulse, he turned his lapse into triumph, raising the baton and making a sign of the cross with it in a gesture of blessing and farewell, adding that night, though without design, to the proud traditions of the Triumphi Club. The girl led him down the candlelit passage into a small room with a narrow bed. On this, with some laughter but no words, she lay down and waited for him. The melted sugar had leaked from her. He saw the shine of it on her thighs. Without words or touch of the mouth, they copulated briefly and violently. She clutched at him and made an angry cry, and he felt the slight knifing of her nails. He was released in a series of groaning shudders and fell down beside her like a stone and slept at once. He woke to a throbbing head and a feeling of utter desolation. There was a grey light in the room. The woman was gone. The tavern and the streets outside were silent, and he judged it to be not long after dawn. There was a jug of water and a basin on the small table against the window. He washed his face and hands, drying himself with his handkerchief. The room looked out over the courtyard and the stables, half obscured in mist. Erasmus shivered a little in the chill air. A certain impulse of escape came to him. He would rouse the lad in the loft over the stables, have his horse saddled, his cloak and boots fetched. The streets would be quiet. At this hour even crime was sleeping. But he made no move yet to leave. His white baton was still there by the bed, where he had let it fall. He went to pick it up. The movement sent shoots of pain through his head. Holding the baton, he stood for some minutes longer in the dim room, going over things in his mind, recapitulating his assets. He had passed his initiation triumphantly, he knew it. Everything lay in his hands. He was acknowledged leader of the younger set, and his position in the association would enable him to influence events and steer business the way of Fletcher and Kemp. Fletcher was old, and he had no sons. Day by day he was relinquishing control. Now that the debts were paid, more money would be free for investment. He would go into banking on his own account. The future lay with those who dealt in money, not commodities. It lay with people like himself, people who could see. Why, then, did he feel this desolation, which was not sickness of body, which would not be dismissed as the aftermath of debauch, coming as it did at other times, and often quite unexpectedly, a feeling of being thrust without shelter under remorseless skies? The successful cannot be unhappy. It was a contradiction in terms. But as he stood there, in this time of licensed introspection, with night over and duties of day not yet resumed, he fell again to rehearsing in his mind the actions he was about to take, as if seeking to give them, and with them his life as a whole, some fuller reality. Crossing the greasy cobbles, shouting for the stable lad, perhaps he would climb to the loft to shake him awake, his horse would be led out, snorting in the cold air, and he would turn her head south towards the river and ride through the empty streets. Suddenly, he felt like a man who has played by the rules and been cheated by an opponent more cunning, so cunning that it was not possible to see how the trick had been done. Chapter 38. At home, he found his man, Hudson, already up and dressed and waiting with his usual discreet blend of deference and reproof. Hudson had been with him for almost 8 years now, and was licensed in various ways, but Erasmus cut him short this morning, sending him off in a hurry to make tea and get water heated for a bath. He stayed a long time in the scented tub, Hudson labouring back and forth with buckets of warm water to pour over him. When he rose from this long immersion, he was feeling slightly languid, but triumphant again. He dressed, as usual, with the greatest care, in a plain shirt and a suit of dark broadcloth. He was intending to spend the rest of the day at the offices of the bank, on Cheapside, where he was due to meet the owners of a shipping company in need of short-term credits. However, he had scarcely finished dressing when Hudson came to announce a visitor, a Captain John Phillips, who had called without appointment.
"See, Captain?"
"Yes, sir. A merchant captain, by the look of him."
"There is none of that name in our books. Does he say what he wants?"
"No, sir. When I asked him to state his business, he spoke short to me, as if he thought I should be hauling on the ropes. All he will say is that he has something of interest to impart to you."
Erasmus sighed. "I don't doubt it," he said. "But whose interest, his or mine? That is the question, Hudson."
"Yes, sir."
"Well, you'd better show him into the study."
Making his way there some minutes later, Erasmus found himself facing a thick-set, weathered-looking man of middle years, in nankeen trousers and a buff-coloured topcoat.
"I'm Erasmus Kemp," he said, advancing to shake his visitor's hand. "You have some business with me, I believe. I'm rather pressed this morning."
"Not business, sir, not exactly business," the captain said. He hesitated for some moments, as if not sure how to proceed, though his gaze remained firmly on Erasmus.
"I knew your father," he said, "by repute. I mean, not personal. I'm a Liverpool man, sir."
"Indeed." Erasmus had stiffened involuntarily at this reference to his father, but the captain's blue eyes under their thick, fair brows wore a frank and friendly expression.
"Aye, sir. And I knew Captain Thurzo, on rather closer terms, too close for comfort. I sailed under Thurzo once before I got my own ship. Once was enough, more than enough." "Sir, excuse me, my time is short this morning. May I ask where this is leading?"
"The Liverpool Merchant, that was her name, his last ship. There was a deal of talk at the time. There is always talk about a ship that goes down. And this was a new-built ship. I remembered it, being your father's ship and skippered by Thurzo."
"Well, you're right enough. That was her name. She had a figurehead on her of a big-breasted woman with flowing hair. That is right, is it not, just to be sure?"
"Why, yes." Into his mind there came the memory of that distant afternoon in Oates's workshop by the Mersey. The staring figures, the smells of pitch and varnish, the irascible carver limping among his creations, his father's enthusiasm for the huge, garish duchess looming above them with her yellow hair and blue dress, her look of a captive giant. He had shared that day, in that sorcerer's den, something of the feeling for the ship that had possessed his father. He had his love for Sarah, then, to open his heart to wonder.
"What do you mean," he said on a note of anger, "to come here and talk to me of a ship that was lost 12 years ago with all aboard her?"
"She was not lost." Erasmus raised a hand quickly to his temple, a habit since childhood when he was distracted or confused.
"Not lost?"
It came to him now that his visitor might be dangerous. There was a heavy glass paperweight on the desk before him, the only thing that could serve as a weapon in this room. He moved his right arm a little nearer to it. But there was nothing of madness in the tanned, bluff-featured face of the man opposite him. If the captain had noticed the movement, he gave no sign of it.
"I saw her less than 6 months since," he said. "What is left of her? I'm here fitting out a ship, and took occasion to find you out and tell you of it. She is beached up on the southeast coast of Florida."
Erasmus stared at him.
"Beached? You mean wrecked on shore?"
"No, I mean hauled up deliberate. She was a good way from the shore." Some of the diffidence or uncertainty had returned to the captain's voice. It was as if he, too, had been visited by disbelief.
"Further than a man would ever expect to see a ship," he said in a lower tone.
"Florida?" Erasmus raised a hand to his face again.
"What should the ship be doing there, so far to westward? She never reached Jamaica. What rigmarole is this? I'm speaking of what I've seen with these eyes."
There was an angry brusqueness in the captain's voice now.
"I thought it my duty to come," he said. "I'll not take any more of your time, sir."
"No, no," Erasmus raised his hand.
"Pardon me," he said. "I intended no offence. I must hear the rest of what you have to say. Your words came as a shock to me. My father died in that same year the ship failed to return, and the circumstances of my life were altogether changed."
"I know it." Phillips was gruff still, but modified. "I was sorry to hear of it." Erasmus smiled at him.
"Will you not sit?" he said. "I have some good Madeira here in my cabinet, or if that is not to your taste, my man can fetch you something else." "What you keep close at hand is good enough for me," the captain said, returning the smile. Pouring out the wine, Erasmus found his hands slightly unsteady. "Now, sir," he said, "you have my full attention." Thus encouraged, and more at ease now, coat unbuttoned and glass in hand, the captain began his story. He had been in the Africa trade, it seemed, but not for slaves, except incidentally. His main trade now was in timber and hides between the North American colonists and the Spanish islands of the Caribbean. He had been following his usual route northward through the Florida Straits, bound for Norfolk, Virginia. They had anchored at a latitude of some 27 degrees, south of a point on the coast known as Boca Nueva, where there were fresh springs. He had sent a party ashore for water and firewood, and to shoot whatever game they came upon.
"No man is perfect, sir," the captain said, shaking his head, "and seamen less so, perhaps, than others, being confined together for long periods. They contrived to draw off some rum from the ship's stores and carry it to shore with them. It was not enough to take their legs away, but it was enough to make them wild and heedless. They sighted a party of Indians and gave chase, hoping to catch the women among them. At least that is how I understood the matter. They tried to pretend otherwise later to lighten their punishment. There are Indian bands along that coast, sir, so much is true. They are hostile to white men, and their arrows can give a death wound if they strike in the right place. What these men did was folly, to rate it no worse. They were led on further than they intended, especially the two foremost, and found themselves in a swampy, wooded ground, where the only way forward was by following the course of a dry creek bed. This took them round in a blind curve, and so they came upon her quite sudden, they said. Tilted over, in the bed of the creek, one side of her jammed against the bank, with creepers trailing over her, and her decks half rotted away, and both her masts down. That is how they told it to the mate, and that is how the mate told it to me." The captain shook his head again. "Out of sight of the shore she was," he said. "In the middle of swamps and trees, sir, where no ship has any business to be. She was an uncanny sight, even for me, who was prepared for it by their account. Her name was there, on the scroll, below the quarter figure, faded, but you could still make it out." He had gone himself, led by the men who had found her. He had clambered over the sloping, gaping planks of her deck, and found his way below to the captain's cabin. "Nothing much there but rubbish," he said. "She'd been well picked over, by those who left her there, I suppose, and by the rats that were aboard with them, and maybe the Indians after. But I found this, behind a rotted bulkhead." He put a hand into the pocket of his coat and drew out a square-shaped book bound in black buckram, shredded and ragged now. "'Twas in a wood box," he said. "The damp has done for most of it, but some pages can still be read. It is the ship's log." Erasmus reached out his hand for it, with a sense of slow, protracted motion sometimes felt in dreams. His thoughts, too, had slowed. There was nothing in his mind but the strangeness of what the captain had told him. "But is it sure?" he said, with some instinct of gaining time. "Can you be sure it is the same ship?" "She's a Snow, sir, a two-master, Liverpool made, and there's a name on her, and the figurehead. But how could she have got up so far, away from the water?" He felt again the need to compose himself, the need for time. He was aware of the captain's eyes resting steadily on him. "Perhaps you will tell me she crawled," he said. "The land keeps low on that piece of coast. It does not rise more than a few feet, and it is soft, sir, sand and shingle and mud. The Atlantic tides come in very strong, but perhaps you know those parts." "No, not at all." "The sea makes roads into the land, and they run deep sometimes. I've known of 4 and 5 fathom depth. Behind the shore it is a maze of mud flats and streams and lagoons, and they are changing all the time, silting up into swamp, changing their courses, running into creeks that go for miles. That coast never looks the same from one year to the next, and I know it better than most. Your father's ship lies in a channel that is narrowed now and half choked up, but it could have held deep water 12 years ago, deep enough to tow a ship, taking her at full tide and hauling from the banks. But the men who did that, who laboured to do it, must have been desperate to hide her from sight of the sea. Aye, that is what it looks like. And they succeeded in it. She would not have been found now but for the accident of the men getting drunk. 100 ships could water there without knowing anything of her. Men go to shoot pig in the scrub or fowl at the edges of the lagoons, but no one goes into the swamps behind. Why should they?
And the captain? Erasmus spoke with a strange constraint. It was as if he wanted the other to supply him with judgment.
Surely he could not.
Thurzo was not a man to abandon his own ship, not willingly. But this is speculation. I was concerned only to tell you what I could vouch for.
He set down his eyes and rose to his feet.
I saw the vessel with my own eyes, he said.
He moved towards the door, then stopped and looked back at Erasmus, who had also risen now.
It is all I know for definite, he said,
but I sail in those waters regular, now that Florida has been given to us by the Spaniards, and I have heard stories. I did not pay much heed to them before.
What stories?
The Indians, who trade with Cuba from the Florida Keys, tell of a kind of settlement somewhere back behind the coast, where white and black live together, and no one is chief.
But 12 years, Erasmus said. How could men remain hidden there?
It is feasible, Philip said, after a moment of reflection. The southern part of Florida is a wilderness. It is trackless and empty of humankind, save for some scattered Indians. The Spanish never went down so far, not that I know of. There was no reason why they should. For 7 of these last 12 years they have been fighting a war to keep the colonies that really matter to them. A remote part of the Florida Peninsula was of interest to no one. Yes, it is feasible.
Erasmus was silent, and the captain, perhaps taking the silence for disbelief, he was a prideful man and sensitive in his own way, held out his hand rather abruptly.
I did not say I believe the stories, he said. With Indians, you do not know if they're speaking of today or yesterday or 100 years ago. Well, I've done what I came to do. Now I must take my leave of you. One moment.
Erasmus appeared to rouse himself from some private musing. I am extremely obliged to you for this intelligence you have brought me.
Be good enough to let me know where you are lodging, so I may send you a mark of my gratitude.
So much is not necessary.
I do not imply that it is necessary.
Erasmus practiced his smile again. He had formed no conscious intention other than to send a sum of money. It was right that a man should be rewarded for his trouble, and there was not a sufficient sum in the house, but he knew even now that the money was merely a pretext. He had to know where Phillips could be found.
I would esteem it a favour, he said.
Pressed thus, the captain complied. He was staying at the Bull in Southwark. He took his leave, and Erasmus found himself alone again, with a tattered black book on the desk before him. The interview had made him late. There was no time now for more than a cursory look. Phillips had been right. The log was largely indecipherable. Mould had attacked the covers and outer pages, obliterating the names of captain and ship. Everywhere damp had spread the ink, running the lines together into blurred webs. The quality of the hand did not help. It was crabbed and uneven, the writing of a man not at ease with a pen. But occasionally, and particularly in the latter part, there were entries that could still be made out. Dates, details of weather and navigation. His eye caught a name. Haynes, set in irons for some offence not named. He had no time now for more. When he left the house, the log went with him, but it was not until late in the afternoon that he was able to look at it again. All through the day's business he had found himself recalling, half incredulously, fragments of his interview with the captain, dwelling on details of his visitor's words and manner, as if to detect some falsity in them that would discredit his story, dispel this monstrous notion that men had deliberately abandoned his father's ship. He was alone now, in his office. In the larger room adjoining, the clerk still laboured at the long counter, heads studiously lowered. He could see the line of heads and backs, if he chose to, through the spy-hole set in his door. The offices were at the rear of the building, looking towards the quiet courts south of St. Paul's. The din of the streets was muted here. The evening had darkened early, and he had lit the lamp on his desk. Behind him, a fire burned in the grate, with a faint, persistent whispering. He took the logbook from his drawer and began to look through it again. He saw an entry for November 1752, again with a name. It was the names he paused at.
bartered with a Frenchman for 4 ounces of brandy, bought 1,300-weight rice of Tucker's people. They brought a man slave aboard, but it being late, promised to bring him off betimes in the morning.
A musty odour came to him from the softened, slightly swollen pages. Misfortune was apparent, even through the bare entries that had survived.
"No slant of wind anyway," he read. "Buried a woman of a fever which destroyed her in 5 days. There are now 67 lost, and still in the..."
It was near the end of the log, on a page largely effaced, that he found what all this while he had been looking for.
"Sea breeze came in, but soon overpowered by a smart tornado, obliging us to furl all and come to anchor in 25 fathoms. Following morning, when hatches raised, found 4 slaves dead in their irons. My consoler tells me jettison the sick. The men are muttering against me. They are given countenance by Paris, who sets himself. Sorry now I gave passage to..."
The name that followed was illegible. Erasmus read through the entry again with utmost care. When he looked up, it was with a feeling of gratitude he did not yet understand, though it was fierce enough to contort his face. His cousin had been there then, still alive at the end, for the log was finished now, only a page remained, and that quite illegible. Paris had played a part in what had happened to the ship. The abbreviation puzzled him somewhat. He could not understand who might have given Thurzo this advice. There was no doubt now that this was Thurzo's log. Perhaps the first mate. His mind went back to a day at the shipyard when he had seen them come round together, passing through the shadows of the ship's bows, out again into the sun, the heavy, deliberate captain and the sharp-faced mate, Barton, his name. He had lifted his head and sniffed at the breeze like a dog. His thoughts reverted to his cousin, settled on him slowly and with curious care, as though aiming. The clumsy, laughing boy, with the sleeves too short, who had lifted him away from his failure on the beach, thereby becoming a mortal enemy. The studious youth of his mother's recommendations. The pale man with the lined face and the hedge parson's hat and the shadow of misfortune and disgrace upon him. He was unable to imagine how his cousin might look now, but he knew him in that moment for a leader of mutiny, a man with blood on his hands. It must be so, if Phillips was to be believed. They must have murdered the captain. They had hauled the ship out of sight of the land, hacked down her masts. They could never have intended to return. Return to what? They had taken the negroes off her. That was theft. They had appropriated the ship's cargo and carried it to shore, so there was piracy to add to the other counts. White men and black men living together with no chief. Not only Thurzo's blood. My father waiting for his ship to come home, scanning the maps. Afterwards, it came to seem to him that the intention had been formed then, with the quiet sound of the fire behind him and the faint rattle of traffic coming through from Cheapside. But it was not until some days later that he knew beyond question that he had to go, had to see, and not just the wreck. He knew it by the desolation that swept through him at the thought that Phillips might have left already, might be out of his reach. Until this fear was allayed, he could not rest. He had sent Hudson in the coach with 25 guineas and a note of thanks, and it was Hudson who accompanied him now and waited below while Erasmus spoke to the captain about the 2 men who had come upon the ship. Were either of these still with him? It seemed that one, the ringleader in the business, had been too much of a troublemaker, and Phillips had handed him over to the harsher discipline of a naval frigate at Savannah. But the other man, a man named Harvey, had signed on again and could be found. An altogether steadier man, this, a good seaman. He had been led astray on this occasion by rum and the foolish hope of catching one of the women. "They are simple men, sir," the captain said. He was not best pleased to learn that Erasmus was proposing to take Harvey away from him, a reliable fore-the-mast man being not so easy to replace, but he was conscious that he had himself been treated with generosity. Not to comply would have been ungrateful, even had he felt inclined to go counter to the other's will, which he did not. Kemp was a man who wielded influence, one whom it was unwise to cross, but it was more than that. There was a quality of suppressed passion in him, which Phillips, strong-willed enough himself and used to intractable men, found daunting. So Harvey was found and brought to the Kemp house. He was blonde and ruddy, with the usual expression of cheerful competence, though this was overlaid now at finding himself in such surroundings.
"Now," Erasmus said to him, "how old are you, Harvey?"
The seaman was one of those whom nervousness makes more confiding.
"I am 29, or I am 30.